Hello, it is September 22nd, 2014. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 448 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on sports and earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. We have 1 week left in the Major League Baseball season. I have not talked about baseball for more than a month on this podcast, which is tragic, really. So we're going to do the next 2 weeks of podcast, perhaps the next 3 weeks of podcast, are all going to be baseball. Now, this is where I come with a caveat. By the way, how's everybody doing? Is everybody okay? I know I can't hear you, but I, you know, it feels rude not to just go into it and start talking and not like check in first to see how you're doing. So how's it going? Anyway, it's good. I'm glad you're going well. Thank you for telling me. But the baseball podcast kick off this week with, I would call it indulgent if we weren't talking about one of the best sports columnists in America and one of my personal heroes in the world of sports journalism and, frankly, someone that I'm very honored to call a friend. That's all the good news. The bad news is we're going to be talking about the Cardinals. So, if you are wanting, because it is about to be that time of year when everyone, I know I, when I say this in the past, people are like, well, people always hate the Cardinals. And that may be true. Probably is true. But people really come out of the woodwork hating the Cardinals in October because the Cardinals are always playing in October. So it allows them television every night to spew their misplaced venom that we upstanding Cardinal fans forgive them for because we're such good people. It's the time everybody does that. But we're going to have... with that coming up and with the end of the baseball season coming and the Cardinals in the playoffs, next week we're going to do a full playoff preview because there's only one link left in the season. I'm not sure who that guest is going to be. I have a couple people, a couple hooks out. I have some bait out. If I just threw out a hook, there wouldn't be any bites. I have bait. Actually, I don't know what the bait is. I have no idea what people come on the show. Anyway, so we'll have a full preview of the Major League Baseball playoffs next week. But this week, it's my indulgent Cardinal podcast with Bernie Miklas. If you are a Cardinals fan or you just want to hear, if you just want to sit idly by as your podcast broadcasting device sends you words and you respond by scowling or venom or, you know, you're looking at your phone and you're like, I hate these people. Oh, if you need to get fired up for that, haha, this is your podcast too. Because me and Bernie got to talk about the Cardinals. Shit's on. Let's go. All right, Bernie, first off, thank you for coming on. Now, I already did my intro, which you were lucky enough not to hear, that I really feel like this is around the time of year where I have to start preparing myself for, oh, this is the month where the whole world hates one of the things I care about most in the world. And the Cardinal backlash that comes in October, you saw it last year. I think last year was as loud as it got. I'm fully expecting it to be just as bad this year. Has that become as a surprise to you in the last few, in recent time that this thing, you know, you've been covering the Cardinals and working in St. Louis for so long. This, and of course I've been a Cardinal fan my whole life. There's always been a little bit of, from Cubs fans or Mets fans or so on, but I still find myself somewhat taken aback by some of the Cardinal hate sometimes.
By now, I'm not surprised by it, Will. And by the way, it's great to be with you. It really is. I'm not surprised. You know, I've been conditioned to seeing it. Just traveling around the NL Central is sort of a primer. You know, until you're out on the road with the team and you just see the zeal people have to you know, take the Cardinals down. And most of it's good natured. It's all in good, clean, hard fun. But really, there's also this undercurrent of real dislike, you know, Milwaukee, Cincinnati, not so much Pittsburgh, certainly Chicago. And I think it's understandable, actually. I mean, I've come to understand it more than I used to because I used to think, well, what have these people really done to anybody except win? But I sort of got an, I have to say, you know, almost in an embarrassed way, I sort of am guilty of engaging in some of that conduct that gets people annoyed. I mean, I was, you know, when the Cardinals eliminated the Dodgers last fall, I mean, I did this really smarmy, you know, Cardinal way, beats beats Mickey Mouse way type column. And, you know, going back and reading that a couple months later, I'm kind of like, yeah, no wonder people get irritated. I mean, there's a tendency, first of all, people are going to resent anybody who has sustained success. And that's in all sports. I mean, people want to see the team that's been the best over a long period of time get taken down. I mean, that's just human nature. There's nothing wrong with that. But then on top of it, you have, you know, the best fans in baseball thing. I mean, I happen to think that it's true, or at least they're tied for first. But, you know, when you hear it repeated, if you live in another city, you hear it repeated so often, sort of get banged over the head by it. Of course, you're going to get tired of it and just start to just say, you know, I don't really like these people. Get out of my face. You know, and the third thing is the whole Cardinal Way thing, which is really, I think, rather innocent, because we're talking about an instruction manual and a way to teach. Yeah, we're talking about George Kissel and a way to teach the game, a way to approach the game, a way to be the right kind of teammate, how you coach the team, all that stuff. It kind of got misappropriated, you know, to an extent by the media. And I, like I said, I have a small sliver of guilt in that. But it also, you know, Mike Messini, you know, tried to sort of take it and turn it into this, you know, moral platform, which it was never meant to be. So when you add all this up, I can definitely understand why it's annoying as hell to people. I really, truly do. So to just close the circle on this, I definitely understand it better than I used to.
Yeah, I feel like part of it, too, when you really take a step back and look at, I've mentioned this before, but look at not only the success the Cardinals have had in the postseason, but they've specifically beat teams that team's fan base thought that was their year. Like the Nationals 2 years ago, the Brewers 3 years ago, the Rangers 3 years ago, the Mets in 06, the Tigers in 06. There's all these teams, the Pirates last year, like all these things that these teams that they thought it was their year, and here come the Cardinals kind of chugging along in that. And it's weird because, you know, I find, you know, I watch the Cardinals every day, and as you do, and I find myself often finding these teams really frustrating and unlikable even sometimes, until September, when all of a sudden it feels like everything is fixed. What is it about these teams? You look at the last 4 years, people have been calling it Cardinals magic lately in a sneering way, not necessarily in a positive way, but the idea that no matter what, they're still kind of there at the end. They've played their best baseball in September. It feels like all of the little problems they've had all the year are starting to kind of click. They have solved everything, but a lot of the issues they've had coming into the year and all year that have been so frustrating are starting to click together a little bit. Is that by design? Is that just time? Is that regression ultimately coming about? What is it about September, do you think, with the Cardinals? And even under the Matheny regime?
Well, it's a little baffling to me in this regard. You know, I would like to say that it's all about transference, you know, of a winning tradition, something that's passed down through the generations, and that makes for a really good narrative. That's a sweet narrative. But, I mean, think about it. I mean, think of how radically the rosters have changed. Think about from year to year. I mean, even go, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but go back just to even look at the 2012 team 2 years ago. How many players are different on this year's team? And, you know, there's a lot of new players this year that had nothing to do with last year or 2012 or 2011 and certainly 2006. So, it, short of absolutely infuriating Cardinals haters, and rightfully so by me taking some stance that this is some mystical thing that is just somehow, you know, put into the bloodstream here. I mean, which is, of course, nonsense. I'm not sure how to explain it other than the fact that I do think that their leadership is not a showy type of leadership. Messini's not a showman. He's not an instigator. He's, you know, generally a nice guy who is very positive. And you have to look at guys like Matt Holliday and Adam Wainwright, who, and Yadier Molina. You know, Wainwright likes to deal with the media, but none of the three are media hogs, I would say. None of them like to stir things up. None of them are showy, show-off type of guys. They constantly stay on message about staying consistent, not getting too high, not getting too low, stay the course, you know, we know what we're doing here. Just take it one game at a time. This is all very boring stuff, but it works for them. And I do think that this team, generally speaking, has a composure that is ingrained, and I think maybe it comes from the leadership. But look, you know, that's the intangible. So that's the type of stuff that drives people who do advanced stats, and I'm one of them. You know, drives us crazy because it sounds like we're spinning a narrative. But I do think there's something about, you know, kind of a dogged consistency. The Cardinals, I wrote about this 3-4 weeks ago, and I think others have picked up on it. I mean, you go by the Cardinals' monthly records this year. I mean, they've had a winning record every month, and most of the records are very ordinary, you know, 15-13, big deal. But yet, they're the only team in the division that's done that. I mean, you know, and they sort of stick to the business at hand, and they don't get caught up in a lot of psychodramas or these things where, you know, the sky is falling, or, hey, we're the best that ever lived. Look at us. We're pounding our chest. They just kind of go out and grind, and it's not sexy, and it's certainly not glamorous, but it works for them. And on top of that, they've also had very good pitching, and that maybe that should be the top of the list.
Yeah, and I want to get into the nitty-gritty a little bit on the Cardinals, because, you know, and I feel obliged to point out that, you know, they've not won the division yet. The Pirates are very dogged themselves in a lot of ways and have been as hot as anyone. But, you know, I want to dig into the Cardinals, because no matter what, they're in the playoffs, and certainly I think they're at 90%+ odds to win the division by Baseball Prospectus. Certainly, all I want to know is if they win the division, if they're going to jump in the pool. That seems like something they probably won't do. If it happens in Arizona, that feels like something Matheny will not allow to happen. There'll be no Puig jumping in the Arizona pool. But I do want to get nitty-gritty about this team. I kind of want to start with Matheny. Matheny, I think, like a lot of Cardinal fans, particularly those in the more advanced stat community, has at times... if it's seemed this year like he's regressed. I think not so much regressed in strategy, though maybe a little of that, and more, you know, the thing with Matheny, and you've talked about this, the thing with Matheny that we were sold that Matheny was this guy that was going to play with young, that trusted young players, and there were so all these young players come to the Cardinals system. He was one that would trust them to play, and this year, most egregiously with Colton Wong, but then later with Oscar Tavares and Alan Craig. He seemed to kind of revert to this nightmarish version of Tony La Russa, who would eventually trust young players himself, where he would just only, he was this stubborn old salt. And, you know, and it feels like, but I can't tell if I was just angry at him because the Cardinals weren't playing well, because I think he's still kind of doing that September, but I'm not angry because they're winning. Is he gotten worse, or has he gotten better, or is he the same?
Well, over, it's a tough question to answer because overall, I thought this year was kind of a step back for him because I don't think he used his personnel. He maximizes personnel the way he should have, and he was very quick to bail out on young players, and he was very stubborn with sticking with Alan Craig, which until finally John Mozeliak had to intervene. And yeah. Let's make no mistake about this. I don't care how many other people try to spin it. This was a direct intervention.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Alan Craig, God bless him, again, nothing personal here, but you can make the case that he's one of the two or three worst players in baseball this year. You factor the base running into it. And he looks like he's just going dramatically off course and physical reasons or whatever, but you know, Matheny and John Mabry, the hitting coach, made it clear that they were going to continue to give him every chance to play. And they had to work Tavares in there in right field. They knew that, but they were not going to pull the plug on Alan Craig. And this could have been absolutely disastrous. And Mozeliak just said, you know, basically, look, I gotta step in here, or you know, we're going to blow this thing. And I'm oversimplifying, of course, but that's basically what happened. And since he got Alan Craig out of here, it's almost like this is where, in my opinion, Mozeliak did a favor to the manager. Not only did he make his team better in that regard, and this obviously had something to do with wanting John Lackey, but to me this was a secondary factor. To me, the most important thing, you had to open up your offense. You had to end this longing and this yearning and this belief that Alan Craig would suddenly get it all back in an instant. It certainly wasn't going to happen. And Mozeliak did the manager a favor on a couple different levels here. First of all, he made his team better by taking his worst player out of the mix. The second thing is that it opened Matheny's mind, in my opinion. Matheny now, I think, in the last, since this trade has been made, has done a really good job of using right field in a way that most benefits the team on a given day. I'm not saying he does it every day, but he's finding really good platoon matchups with Grichuk and Tavares. He's sort of dangling the carrot, I think, in a productive way to Tavares, because Tavares has to earn his playing time. It's one thing to say to Tavares, no, you got to go sit on the bench because we're sticking by Alan Craig. Right. He's awful, but that's just the way it is. But when you see, but when your alternatives in right field are John Jay, who's been one of the best hitters in baseball in the second half, and Grichuk, who kills left-handed pitching, and guys who can run and throw and do all kinds of other things, play good defense, well, playing time has to be earned then, and Tavares gets that. I think Tavares was confused, like, well, what do you mean? I'm not better than Alan Craig right now, or I'm sitting because of this. He didn't say that, but I can only imagine that was going through his head. But anyway, by getting Craig out of here, I think it just opened up a whole new world to Matheny about how you utilize personnel. He's done, in my opinion, a really, really good job of mixing and matching in his outfield since that trade was made. And he's also, I give him a lot of credit for adjusting. He was too late to adjust, but he adjusted in terms of Pat Neshek and Trevor Rosenthal, the back end of games. He was killing both of those guys by using them too much. He finally backed off and is at least trying to have a rational way of bullpen usage where he's not running them into the ground. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's a lot better. So, long-winded answer, but it took a long-winded answer because it's a complex issue. I think Matheny was taking a step back this year. I definitely do. But I think in recent weeks, 6 weeks, 7 weeks, whatever you want to call it, I think he's gotten a lot better. And again, not saying he's perfect, but I think he's gotten a lot better.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, one thing I wonder is, one thing we've kind of learned about Matheny is he really likes people to have roles. And, you know, we can disagree about that, but he clearly, like, philosophically believes players will perform better if they know their specific role and they know what they're doing and they know when they're coming, either they're a bullpen guy coming in a certain inning or a guy's going to know he's going to line up every day or whatever. But that does seem, even with Matheny's, I think, improvement, because he had no other choice, because he couldn't put Craig in anymore, that still feels at odds with the way that Mozeliak is constructing this team for the mid to long term, and that having depth and having flexibility, it feels still like it's, I'll put it this way, it seems fundamentally strange that Mozeliak would to get Matheny to do what he's wanting to do. I always joked at the time that, okay, so we know what Matheny has cost us this year. He's cost Joe Kelly. The fact is, you had to give Joe Kelly to Boston to get them to take Craig. They wouldn't take Craig for Lackey. So you had to give
him. No doubt, I agree.
Yeah, so you basically it cost them Joe Kelly that stubbornness. So I'm glad, I agree that there's been this improvement at the end of the year, but it still feels like this is going to be a problem until someone's going to have to give.
Well, I agree, and I think the fact that he's, like you quote a baseball perspective, right now as we record this, they have a 95.5% chance of winning the division. So let's assuming that they go ahead and do it. You know, that's going to be more success. That's going to be three times in a row in the playoffs for a young manager who didn't have experience. I think part of it is that, and I apologize for trying to psychoanalyze Matheny. It's not fair, but I can't help. Yeah, but I can't help but come to the conclusion that the successes has kind of emboldened him to where he was this prodigy, and Mozeliak, you know, he was gonna be the game. You know, Mozeliak, he was all on board with the young player concept, and he kind of understood the way things had to be run, and you know, Mozeliak made it very clear about what was expected, and then all of a sudden he wins it. You know, first 2 years on the job, he wins a pennant his second year, gets to the sixth game of the World Series, and all of a sudden. I'm overstating this, but all of a sudden it's like, well, wait a minute, I've got this all figured out, you know, now this is my team, you know. And I think it kind of sets up a trap for a young manager, and he's still a very young manager, thinking he has all the answers when maybe, you know, he speeded up his own learning curve in his mind, that he had a lot of this figured out that maybe he really didn't. And I do think that going forward, especially now this is a third year of consecutive year of success, yeah, I definitely think it could lead to some problems. Like, even in recent days, look, I just praised Matheny because I think he's gotten better, and I really do, but I don't live in an absolute black or white, all or nothing world. I also look at Colton Wong. He sort of forgot about him a little while there recently. You know, all of a sudden, he's on the bench. It's like, why? How are they possibly better with him on the bench? That happened over this recent stretch a little bit. It took him until, what, 3 weeks ago or so to figure out a role for Carlos Martinez. I mean, this is one of the top pitching prospects in baseball, one of the best young arms in baseball. And they have, up until recent weeks, I mean, they have largely wasted his season. I mean, this is a really precious resource. So I don't know. I don't entirely trust him when it comes to young players, and I think he still has to earn that trust. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what next year is going to look like along these lines.
Yeah, you know, I got a press release about a couple months ago from Crown Publishing on February 3rd, 2015. The Matheny Manifesto, the book. You know, he wrote, famously wrote that Little League Manifesto that I think partly got him the job, to be honest. And the Matheny Manifesto, a young manager's old school look at success in sports and his life, is released at February 3rd, 2015. If the Cardinals have just won the World Series, or at least had a lot of success, not gotten swept in the first round of the playoffs, and Matheny's coming out with that kind of success, and then has a book, a young manager's old school look at success. I just don't see how him and Matheny are going to be on. I mean, him and Mozeliak are going to be on the same page. But I don't want to get too caught up on Matheny because there are good things happening with Cardinals.
No, that's all right. I'm like you. I mean, look, the bottom line is he wins. And I think, and by the way, I think he's a really good leader. And some people would say, well, wait a minute. Part of leadership is using your best players, maximizing your roster. So that's not. If he's not doing that, then how can you say he's a good leader? Because it's what we talked about a few minutes ago. I mean, he does have a positive approach that works with this group. I'm not saying that it would work in other places. It works with this group because his top leaders sort of are in sync with his personality. These players like playing for him. They know that he has their back. They know that he's going to be really supportive. They know he's not a guy to roll on veterans too quickly. I mean, they saw the way he maintain this vigil over poor Alan Craig and wasn't going to leave his side, so to speak. That kind of stuff plays well in the clubhouse. But it also took the general manager's intervention to shake up the team, give it some edge, get Alan Craig out of here, open up the possibilities of platooning and young talent in right field for the Cardinals. So there is no definitive answer on Mike Matheny. It's very complicated. You know, there's some really, really good things. There's some very disturbing things. And, one other thing to add to the pile of that concerns me anyway is that I worry sometimes that he sort of wants to fit all players into a certain, pardon the cliche, but a certain cookie-cutter mold. He doesn't like a cocky kid like Oscar Tavares necessarily. He doesn't like Carlos Martinez, being flamboyant on the mound and pumping his fists and going crazy when he gets a big out. I mean, I heard this stuff coming out of spring training and was scratching my head. It's like, this Colton Wong's a good kid, but he's awfully confident for a guy who hasn't done anything. Now, Matheny didn't say that, but I'm just saying repeated to me by some veteran players. It's like, well, we like Colton, but he's a little confident. This whole idea that young players are ready to conquer the world and they're brash, they're confident, they're cocky maybe, but they're ready to just get after it. Somehow he's into this whole, you got to know your place and pay your dues thing. And to repeat your point that you made earlier, I think a lot of people thought that kind of stuff ended when La Russa retired, and the fact that, the fact that you have to understand that not all players are the same personality types. I mean, there are differences in major league clubhouses. They can't all fit the same personality mold, and that's another thing about him that I wonder about at times, and we'll see how it evolves.
Yeah, I just know that book. Everyone's going to make – Deadspin's going to have so much fun with that book. It's going to be the worst. I'm going on vacation in February. Okay, I'm getting out of here. Okay, so I'm going to go over a few specifics about this team kind of heading into the playoffs. A few questions I have, I just kind of want to run by you and see what you think. First off, the rotation. I think it's clear that Wainwright and Lynn are 1-2. Lackey looked very solid. One thing I really like about Lackey is the same thing that drove me crazy about him when he was with the Red Sox or with the Angels. Though he definitely looks better with a beard The beard is helping him. The beard, I like the beard on Lackey. He was a little doughy when he didn't have the beard. He looks like fiercer and sharper now. But he is the one guy that like I feels like when Matheny took him out the other day, I legitimately thought Lackey was going to eat him. Like, I thought Lackey was going to, like, attack him and throw him into the dugout, which I think is the type of thing, and we've talked about this after the trade, you know, that was the type of thing I think the Cardinals needed a little bit, is Lackey, Waka looked a little better the other day, Miller has looked solid. What do you think the Game 3 and Game 4 starters are in an NLDS, assuming the Cardinals make an NLDS, and does it matter if they're playing the Dodgers or if they're playing the Nationals or if they're at home, if they're away, does that make a difference?
Oh man, it's a big question. There's so many questions involved in this, the composition of the rotation, because you know as you sussed out there. I mean, you know, there's three guys and only two of them will be in there. You know, it's Lackey, Walker, Miller, two of the three. Well, like, so do you bump Lackey even though the general manager made a huge trade and gave up you know, two very popular players, including a young pitcher with a lot of talent to get him? I mean, do you really scratch John Lackey, a guy who won Game 7 in 2002 World Series for the Angels, a guy that won Game 6 to clinch the last year's World Series for the Red Sox? I mean, do you really bump him from the rotation? I mean, man, that's one question. Number two, Shelby Miller's been dramatically improved since adding a curveball to his repertoire, making it a legitimate secondary pitch, something he has not had in his career up until this point. I thought last year it made perfect sense for him to be scratched from the rotation. It seemed to be a mystery to a lot of people. It's not a mystery to me. His stuff was backing up because he was a one-dimensional pitcher. His fastball became very hittable. He had nothing else to go to. Of course, he was vulnerable, so what's the point of having him in your postseason rotation? But now he's a more complete pitcher, and he's been fantastic. So what's the message you send to him? Well, you did exactly what we asked you to. You're exceeding our wildest dreams. All right, here, go to the bullpen now. I mean, that's tough. Do you with Michael Waka, it's kind of a two-sided question. It's like, are they just clinging to some kind of flimsy hope that, well, we saw what he did last year, he can do it again? When, you know, realistically, considering how little he pitched, is it really fair to the guy to expect him to replicate or even come close to doing what he did last October? I mean, that's an awfully big assignment to ask a guy to be what he was last year, considering the injury he had and all the time that he missed. And then I think it comes down to, like you pointed out, opponent, and they'll go through the numbers, and I haven't done them. I should have prepared for you.
Oh, please.
But, you know, how does Miller match up against Dodgers hitters? How does Lackey match up against Dodgers? The other thing is, who's best suited for relief? Like, in other words, I don't think whoever is not in this rotation is going to be just, you know, not given a uniform for the postseason. He'll go to the bullpen. Well, of the three, who's best suited to be an asset or a true asset in a relief role? I would think it would be Miller, but I'm not advocating putting him in a relief role. But I want your opinion. I mean, of the three, who would be best suited to come out of the bullpen and really be an asset? I don't know.
I have to say, I'm kind of leaning toward Waka. Like, I kind of like the idea of, because he's really not stretched out yet. In fact, Matheny almost tried to stretch him out, like last game, I think a little longer than they meant to. And I think it ended up, typical Matheny, he was trying to get him a win. and he stretched him out like five or six more pitches than he probably should have. But, like, I feel like, because, I mean, Waka looked good last time, but I feel like with Miller, not only are you putting Miller in that after you've asked him to do this and he's pitched so well, you'd be putting him in the exact same situation you put him in last year. And in a situation that seemed to have screwed him up a little bit at the beginning of this year. And you've the Miller that you've seen, and Derek Gould, your colleague and my friend, has talked about this too, about how, like, Miller is a different pitcher since that trade. He's just, like, mentally and, like, approach, like, everything is better. To me, the weapon of those three guys, the guy that has the best stuff, I think, is Waka. But the guy that you can count on to go six innings the least is Waka. So for me, as much as we all want to see Waka do that, do what he did last year, it's like that's a guy I would mind seeing in a seventh inning or even a sixth inning if someone's in struggle. Maybe Waka is the training wheels for anyone that gets in trouble or even slight trouble. But see, that's another Matheny problem, and you've talked about this on your podcast, and I know I'm just ranting about Matheny again, but like you don't see that kind of like La Russian aggression. Of the idea of, like, I think they talked about this on the Viva Alberto's podcast too, the idea that, you know, La Russa, he saw managing in the playoffs as like, I'm going to put the other guy on his back heels and I'm going to make that guy make decisions. It was so fun to watch him do that to poor Ron Washington. Like, I feel bad for the guy because La Russa just like hammered him, other than of course the bullpen fun incident. But like, to me, that's something I like, the idea of having this incredible weapon of Michael Wacha to just use whenever you need to, in a way that you don't know if you can trust him in the rotation. But I think it requires a level of inventiveness that I don't know that I've seen.
Well, I would go with that. You know, I could make the case for Miller just strictly in terms of pitching profile. But again, I think you make a great point. You know, how do you do this to the guy 2 years in a row, especially when he seems to be really, things have clicked in. He has responded beautifully to the Joe Kelly trade and the shakeup. And he told Derek Gould, it's just like, hey, that could have been me. And I don't want it to be me. I want to stay here. And I'm not saying he wasn't trying before. It's like a lot of young players. They get a little bullheaded. And I think the light bulb finally went on. It's just like, well, wait a minute, man. I want to stay here. I want to be here forever. I don't want to blow this. What do I need to do? Let's go. And he's really been terrific. So it would be a really almost cruel thing to banish him to the bullpen, even though he could help them in the bullpen. So I don't disagree with anything you said about Waka. It's just which one makes the most sense. I think either one makes sense. The politics come into play, though. Yeah. And I think maybe putting Miller back in the bullpen would be a lot more, you know, sensitive and a lot would raise a lot more question. And I think it stir controversy a lot more than putting Waka in the bullpen.
And it's hard to imagine. I don't even see the benefit. Like, Lackey, I don't think is a major benefit in the bullpen anyway. Like, other than just pissing him off. Like, I feel like I'm not sure he's the type of bullpen kind of arm you want anyway.
No. First of all, it takes him a long time to warm up. It really does. And so that it would be counterproductive in that regard. Yeah. You know, because you'd almost have to have an appointment, you know, where it's like, look, we're going to give you, you know, a day's notice, you know, you start warming up in the fifth inning, you know, it just doesn't work that way when, you know, things are very much on the fly and spontaneous in postseason baseball. Things happen in a hurry. Yeah, I don't think you can warm up in a way you would need them to, you know, where you could go to them so quickly. You need to go to somebody quickly. Yeah. So anyway.
Okay, how about another question when it comes to that kind of outfield? Again, I feel like mostly Matheny has been pretty inventive, has been able to handle it pretty well. I agree with you on that. But that said, Tavares has had seven at-bats in the last 8 days. And on one hand, I get it. Grichuk's been hot. He's been hitting the ball well. But he's also been hot. Like he's starting to sneak into the lineups against junk ballers and right-handers and the people that – like, the reason Grichuk got hot is because we brought him up to face left-handers, which he hits the crap out of. And I think, again, I know Matheny's going with the hot hand, but do you advocate a strict platoon in right field and then work in Borges in the late innings? Do you want to see Borges get in more? What's your kind of take on how the outfield should work in the postseason? If they're, say, let's say they're facing the Dodgers and you're facing those guys, what do you think about the outfield situation?
Well, assuming, and again, I know that the talk in L.A. is that they hope to get Ryu back, the left-hander back for the postseason, and they're going to need him if that's the case, because, you know, Dan Heron has seen better days. I don't think they want him to be the number three starter. No disrespect to him, one of my favorite people in baseball, but, you know, presuming that, let's just say for the sake of conversation that Ryu does make it back, and I don't know whether he will, but if he does, you know, Cardinals are going to face, you know, how many games started by left-handed pitching in an NLDS? I think you have to go platoon. And this isn't to say that Tavares can't hit left-handed pitching. In the minor leagues, did a very solid job against left-handed pitching. But we're not talking about long-term projections here. We're talking about living in the moment. And I think Grichuk has been, you know, very impressive against left-handed pitching. He destroyed left-handed pitching this year in Triple A. He also gives you the added benefit of defense and base running, which he's better than Oscar in those two areas. As you know, and everybody who follows my work, I'm an Oscar honk. Don't get me wrong, but if you're going to go against an opponent that's going to roll out multiple left-handed starters, I think it makes all the sense in the world to have Grichuk out there in right field for these matchups. And you know, now where I sort of hold my ground on this, though, is that a lot of fans are asking me on Twitter and stuff, it's a great conversation. I just don't have answers for them. It's like, well, do you keep Grichuk or Tavares? Well, I'm like, I know Derek Gould feels this way too. Derek Gould, well, I keep both of them. I don't, you know, you go with five outfielders because, I mean, these guys all bring something to the table. They're assets. Oscar has shown an ability to be a good pinch hitter, effective. It's a small sample, but that's what pinch hitting is. And, you know, you don't scratch a Tavares or a Grichuk at the expense of keeping a second utility out, the infielder, who's not really going to amount to anything. I mean, you know, again, no disrespect to those guys, but I think you have five assets potentially in that outfield, and I think they all need to be on the postseason roster. And how you deploy them after that is fine, but, you know, this talk, like, it's got to be one or the other. I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a nightmare that we're going to see Descalso, who has come around and is also like, Descalso gets a bum rap and from kind of a sabermetric people, I think with good reason in a lot of ways. But, like, you know, what I have to say, every time I watch any highlights of Game 5 of the 2012 NLDS against Washington, which I do more than I probably should admit. I remember how Descalso was a monster that game. And, like, he's been such kind of a vital part of Cardinal history. I think there's, like, good... I have no bad feelings toward the guy. But the idea of... I'm a little afraid that we're going to see, like, Descalso on the postseason roster rather than Tavares. And that makes me very nervous.
Well... I should have mapped all this out. I've done a poor job because I'm not prepared.
You're doing awesome, man.
to sort of go through all the different, you know, right. Roster machinations. Go, really, you need Rick Hummel on here right now. He'd be able to lay it out. But no, I think obviously you've got to have one utility infielder on the team. And whether that's Descalso or Cosma. I can't imagine it would be Mark Ellis, but again, you know, that whole veteran, he's been there before thing comes into play, that old school baseball thing comes into play. But, I mean, do you really need more than one utility infielder? I don't see how when you're probably going to be playing, a Dodgers team that can just, you know, can roll Kershaw out for two starts, maybe Ryu for a start in the first round, you know? So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it seems like a luxury to have that. And, you know, and especially when you look at Colton Wong this year. And again, I know this is all small samples. We're talking less than 100 plate appearances. But, I mean, guys hit .296 with a .451 slugging percentage against left-handed pitching this year. So you wouldn't have to, you know, say, well, wait a minute. We don't want Wong to hit against Kershaw, or we don't want Wong to hit against the left-hander. Well, why not? He's shown that he's done pretty well. I mean, that was certainly the case in the minor leagues. So, to me, that would be a travesty. If he wants to keep Descalso on the roster, I can understand that. And Descalso, I sort of have a little bit of a soft spot for Descalso, much against my better instincts in terms of, you know, statistical analysis. He has done some really good things for this team in the postseason, and I don't discount that. But that's about as far as I personally am willing to go in terms of approving anything. I can't imagine that you would keep a Cosma or an Ellis on the roster at the expense of a Tavares. I just don't see how that makes you better, or especially late innings when you're looking for someone to come off the bench and get a big hit and possibly get an extra base hit.
All right, so this is kind of my last question here, because you've been covering, you've been following this team for so long. I'm curious, does it, you know, this is now, it's kind of a strange thing this year because, again, this team has been so kind of frustrating a large part of the season, though not nearly as frustrating as the 2011 team, a thing we all forget now. We just completely forget how much, like in mid-August, I was like, maybe I just don't like the Cardinals anymore. Like, maybe they've turned 35 years of my life upside down, this team. And, of course, then That happened. So I'm curious, when this team, and I know, so with the caveat that regular season is often forgotten depending on how you do in the playoffs, certainly this feels as workmanlike a potential division title as I can remember. Is this, and I feel like kind of whining saying that, like, oh, we didn't win the division title as exciting a fashion as I would like them to. But I'm curious, does this feel, there have been many times we've talked about this team lacking a lot of life and lacking a lot of vitality, and here they are again. Is this what we want? Is this what we should get used to? Is this something that we're whining, complaining about?
No, I do think that Cardinals fans are spoiled, and I think, you know, I mean, just as a media person, I mean, I'm spoiled too, in that I hold them to really high standards and complain about stuff that I'm sure in other cities people would be laughing at, you know, but that's just it. The Cardinals set these standards for themselves. They're the ones that say every year the goal is to win a championship. They not only mean it, I mean, they've got a bunch of those things hanging up that prove that they're serious about it. And so I think that they should be held to higher standards than most franchises, and that's nothing to do with haughtiness. That's just the reality. I mean, Cardinals since 2004 have played in 29 more postseason games than any franchise in the major leagues. I mean, you know, they've won more postseason games than any franchise in major leagues since 2004. So I mean, there's a very high standard of excellence here. Sneer at it if you will, but that's just a fact. And I do think, though, that this team is set up well pitching-wise to make a good postseason run. And I do think that pitching is more important in the postseason than, you know, if you would ask me, you know, and again, as you just alluded to, I mean, postseason is so random. October is so random. I mean, you know, Anthony Reyes beating Justin Verlander game one of the 2006 World Series. Are you kidding me?
He said that like 17 in a row.
I know, you know, Jeff Suchon, you know, out pitching Tom Glavine. And I mean, you know, seriously, there's no script for this stuff. It's a bunch of lightning strikes. But that said, you know, I'd still, you know, I would rather a team, if I was running a team or managing a team or following a team, and I would prefer strong pitching over a strong lineup, because we've seen 2004 being the classic example. We've seen how a very strong lineup can be just rendered, can be neutered by strong pitching, and it can happen just like that. Strong pitching keeps you in the game. You have a chance to win 2-1 or 3-2. And I think this is, you know, again, I'm saying the predictable thing, but I think this is the way they're going to have to be successful in the postseason. I don't trust this offense. Now, does this preclude the possibility of batted ball randomness, you know, clicking in their favor? Well, no. I mean, of course that could happen. And this team, it seems kind of almost flippant to say, but this team's basically built, the success or failure of this team offensively basically comes down to batted ball randomness. Mm-hmm. They don't hit home runs. They're not a big extra base hitting team. I think they, you know, they have doubles power. Sure, they don't steal bases. It's about drawing walks, grinding out at bats, you know, having a reasonably high on base percentage, and then hoping that one of the ground balls, you know, finds the hole between, you know, second and shortstop, or shortstop and third base. And you know, when the balls are finding the hole, they're formidable. When it's not, they can be pretty feckless. And that's the thing I don't trust about this team. I don't trust the offense. I was looking at it earlier today for something that I was going to write but didn't get around to yet. But, you know, of all the teams that even have a chance to be in the postseason, I mean, this would be the worst offense in terms of runs per game. I mean, the only potential playoff teams that are even closer, Seattle and Kansas City. So they all automatically go in the postseason. You know, if you're talking about a profile, they automatically go in the postseason in the National League as the least accomplished, maybe least imposing offense that there is. And that means they're really going to have to ride their pitching hard. And this is all based on theory, based on regular season facts. And again, we've said 1,000 times, things can change in an instant. October baseball is ridiculously random.
Well, Bernie, I am going, assuming the Cardinals make an NLDS, I will be in St. Louis for it this year. So I'm sure you won't be busy. But
well, I think I owe you. We have to go drink some local product, or well, any product of your choice. Actually,
yes, I agree. I am very. I'm skilled in that regard.
Absolutely, because I missed you on your last visit here, and to much to my regret, but we can make up for it this time.
Absolutely, I'm very excited, and as I said, I look forward to. I just need to prepare myself that if they win that first series, particularly if they beat the Dodgers, a team that everybody seems to love in ways that sometimes confuse me, whatever, we won't get into that. But if that happens, I'll just prepare. I'm going to need you to be my binky and my warm blanket to keep me comfortable, because I still get affected. I'm sorry, I do. I know I have a hard time stealing myself to the everybody hates the Cardinals thing. I need to, and they're fans. Like, I need to thicker skin about Drew Silva, who writes about baseball for Fangraphs a lot of places, for CBS a lot of places. He is a Cardinal fan, and he's very good at fending it off, and you're good at fending it off. And I still get upset about and emotionally, and that's my own fault. Well, so I may need your help.
And you make yourself a target by doing that. Every time I see one of these, or just about every time I see one of these hit jobs on the Cardinals for these things that we're talking about, you know, insufferable fans and this and that, and Cardinal way and holier than thou and all that stuff, you know, invariably your name comes up. You know, seriously, you get pounded a lot on this. So
I know, but I need to be all Drew McGarry about it and be like, yeah, bring it on, jerks, and like make fun of them. But I'm just not good at it. I'm not good at it, and I'm like, no, we're really nice people. Come on, and that doesn't do anybody any good at all.
Well, I mean, I will say this, that's the one thing about this that I don't remember. I told you at the very beginning of our conversation. You know, I definitely understand it. I really do. Why people get so annoyed? Okay, there's one area that I don't understand. You know, sports writers like me, and you know, whether it's so-called mainstream writers, so-called bloggers. I mean, I'm both, so I belong to every family. But you know, you look around, and anytime there's an ugly incident, or anytime there's something going on, and you know, whether it's athletes misbehaving or fans misbehaving. I mean, you read these sermons and these lectures about the, you know, the collapse of civility in sports, and you know, proper conduct, and everyone's a thug, and blah 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 blah. You know, and yet this fan base basically gets ripped to shreds because it's so nice. And it's like, well, what do you want? I mean, I'm not sure what you all want. I mean, do you want civilized behavior and people who are friendly, or do you want people who are, you know, or, you know, who are insufferable because they're, you know, you take your kid to a game and you know, there's a chance someone's going to throw a beer on your kid. I mean, that's happened to friends of mine in other places. I mean, you know, it's like, what do you want exactly? If you think it's okay to, you know, for fans to be throwing beer and whatever, and you know, using bad language and screaming at kids wearing the uniform of the other team in a ballpark, well, that's great, but then just spare me for, you know, hold all the sermons and all the fire and brimstone lectures about the debasement of our culture. You know, just spare me that too. You know, because you can't have it both ways.
Oh, Bernie, I need you to be my binky on this so bad. I'm just gonna hold. Maybe not that specific notion, but I'm just gonna call you anytime I start to get sad. I'm just gonna call. So one, you gave me your number, so you can't hide now.
No, you got it. You're all good, man.
All right, so stick around. We're going to do a little bit of trivia after we wrap up here. But first off, thank you for your time. I'm very appreciative. This is great, and I will see you come in LDS time.
Absolutely. Look forward to it, man.
All right, thank you to Bernie Miklas. You can follow him on Twitter, at Miklas, M-I-K-L-A-S-Z. This is the Willis Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We'll be back tomorrow or Wednesday, I'm not sure which, with the trivia with Bernie Miklas that we're about to do now. Have a great week, everyone, and I'll talk to you and Bernie and the world of trivia tomorrow or the next day. Take care. Be safe.